sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear part of a speech given by Dr. David Ray Griffin at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California on May 15th, 2010, and that'll be followed by some 9/11 and related news updates. But first, for those who don't know Dr. David Ray Griffin, he's written 9 books on 9/11, with 2 more soon to be published. Dr. Griffin is a leading member of the 9/11 Truth Movement and was a professor of theology at Claremont University in Claremont, California. The 9/11 Truth Movement has recently launched a worldwide campaign to educate the public about the mysterious collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 on 9/11. This is the 3rd building that collapsed that was not hit by a plane. The 9/11 Commission report didn't mention it, and there seems to be a blackout in the corporately controlled media about this building. This new campaign is called Building What? And that's also the title of the speech that you're about to hear. So in support of the worldwide Building What campaign, I wanted to share Dr. David Ray Griffin's speech with you. So here he is on May 15th in Santa Cruz, California.
Well, thank you very much. And I want to thank the organizers for this really superb conference. The title of my lecture is Building What? How SCADs Can Be Hidden in Plain Sight.
For those of you who don't know, SCAD stands for State Crimes Against Democracy. And the term comes from the American Behavioral Scientist Journal, who dedicated its entire February 2010 edition to SCADs. If you Google State Crimes Against Democracy, you can learn more about it. There's also a petition online to Congress to do something about SCADs. And now back to David Ray Griffin.
At 5:21 p.m. on 9/11, Building 7 of the World Trade Center collapsed even though it had not been hit by a plane, a fact that is important because of the widespread acceptance of the idea, in spite of its scientific absurdity, that the Twin Towers collapsed because of the impact of the airplanes and then the jet fuel-fed fires. The collapse of Building 7 thereby challenges the official account of the destruction of the World Trade Center, according to which it was accomplished by Al-Qaeda hijackers, even if you do accept the scientifically impossible explanation given by the government. This fact was most recently stressed in the title of a book review of my latest book, Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, by Medal of Science winner Lynn Margulis, in the title of her review, Two Hit, Three Down, The Biggest Lie. The reason why Building 7 poses such a problem to the official theory is that this encounter entails that for the first time in the known universe, a steel-framed high-rise building had been brought down by fire. And science does not like unprecedented occurrences when dealing with physical phenomena. New York Times writer James Glantz, who himself has a PhD in physics, wrote, "Experts say no building like it, a modern steel-reinforced high-rise, had ever collapsed because of an uncontrolled fire." Glantz then quoted a structural engineer as saying, "Within the structural engineering community, Building 7 is considered to be much more important than the Twin Towers because engineers had no answer to the question, why did 7 come down?" Equally remarkable, besides the mere fact that the building came down, was the way it came down, in virtual free fall, making it appear to be an example of the type of controlled demolition known as implosion, in which explosives and or incendiaries are used to slice the building's steel support columns in such a way as to cause the building to collapse in upon itself into its own footprint. CBS anchor Dan Rather not one to let a remarkable fact go unremarked, said, "It's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen on television where a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down." Dan Rather, moreover, was not the only reporter to make such a comment. Al Jones, reporter for New York City news station, said, "I turned in time to see what looked like a skyscraper implosion, looked like it had been done by a demolition crew." Moreover, where Jones and Rather, being laymen in these matters, merely said that the collapse of Building 7 looked like a controlled demolition, experts looking at the video could see that it was a controlled demolition. In 2006, for example, a Dutch filmmaker asked Danny Jowinkel, the owner of a controlled demolition company in Holland, to comment on a video of the collapse of Building 7 without telling him what it was. Jowinkel had never heard that a third building had come down that day. After viewing the film, Jowinkel said, "They simply blew up columns, and the rest caved in afterwards. This is controlled demolition." When asked if he was certain, Jowinkel replied, "Absolutely. It's been imploded. This was a hired job. A team of experts did this." Besides the obviousness from the very appearance of the collapse, that it had been brought down by explosives, there were testimonies about explosions in World Trade Center 7. One of these was provided by Michael Hess, New York City's Corporation Counsel and very good friend of Mayor Rudy Giuliani. While on his way back to City Hall, Hess was stopped for an interview at 11:57 that morning. During that interview, he said, "I was in the Emergency Management Center on the 23rd floor of World Trade Center 7 when all the power went out. Another gentleman and I walked down to the 8th floor," he meant the 6th, "where there was an explosion, and we were trapped on the 8th floor," they went back up, "with smoke, thick smoke, all around us for about an hour and a half, but the New York Fire Department just came and got us out." Hess thereby reported a mid-morning explosion in Building 7. The other gentleman, Barry Jennings, of the New York City Housing Authority, reported the same thing during another man-on-the-street interview, reporting that he and Mr. Hess had been walking down the stairs when they became trapped by a big explosion. Jennings, in fact, said that explosions continued going off in the building while they were waiting to be rescued. Also, during the late afternoon, reporter Peter DeMarco of New York Daily News said, "There was a rumble. The building's top row of windows popped out, then all the windows on the 39th floor, then the 38th floor. Pop, pop, pop was all you heard until the building sunk into a rising cloud of gray." In addition to the visual and testimonial evidence, there was clear physical evidence that Building 7 was brought down by explosives. Within a few months of 9/11, three professors from Worcester Polytechnic Institute had issued a report about a piece of steel from this building that was described in a New York Times story by James Glantz and Eric Lipton as perhaps the deepest mystery uncovered in the investigation. Part of the mystery was the fact that the steel had become extremely thin, indicating that the steel had melted away, even though no fire in the building was believed to be hot enough to melt steel outright. Describing this mysterious piece of steel more fully, an article entitled "The Deep Mystery of Melted Steel" in the Worcester Polytechnic Institute's magazine said, "Steel, which has a melting point of 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, may weaken and bend, but does not melt during an ordinary office fire. Yet a one-inch column has been reduced to a half-inch thickness. Its edges, which are curled like a paper scroll, have been thinned to almost razor sharpness. Gaping holes, some larger than a silver dollar, let light shine through a formerly solid steel flange. The Swiss cheese appearance shocked all of these firewise professors, who expected to see distortion and bending, but not holes. Indeed, the thinning in the holes suggested that the steel had been vaporized, explaining as early as November 2001 why fire could not account for this mysterious steel. Glantz paraphrased one of these three professors as saying, "It appeared to have been partly evaporated in extraordinarily high temperatures." Another New York Times story reported that the same phenomenon was announced by Professor Abulhassan Ostina-Azal of the University of California at Berkeley, who had received a National Science Foundation grant to spend 2 weeks at Ground Zero studying the steel. According to reporter Kenneth Chang, Professor Ostina-Azal, speaking of a horizontal I-beam from World Trade Center 7, said, "Parts of the flat top of the eye, once 5/8 of an inch thick, had vaporized." These reports clearly showed that something other than fire had caused effects, because the fires in the building could not possibly have been hotter than 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, while the boiling point of steel is roughly the same as that of iron, which is over 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. But even if the steel had simply melted, that by itself would have proved the point, because the melting point of steel is only a little less than that of iron, which is 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. Whereas the fire, to repeat, could not, even under the most ideal circumstances, have been above 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. Therefore, clear evidence against the official account of Building 7, according to which it was brought down by fire, existed in plain sight in the form of memories and videos of its collapse, testimonies about explosions, and physical evidence reported even in the New York Times. The reasonable inference to draw from this evidence, namely that the official account is false because explosives were used, was reinforced by the first official report on World Trade Center 7, which was issued in 2002 by FEMA. The scientists who wrote the report for FEMA admitted that their best hypothesis as to why the building came down had only a low probability of occurrence, which is science speak for "we don't have a clue." In addition to all these facts, World Trade Center 7 was a very big building, being 47 stories high. Although it was dwarfed by the 110-story Twin Towers, it would, in half of the states in our nation, been the tallest building in the state. For all of these reasons, the collapse of this building should have become one of the best-known facts about 9/11, but it did not. A Zogby poll in May 2006 found that 43% of the American people were still unaware that World Trade Center 7 had collapsed. And that same year, as mentioned earlier, Daniel Winkel of Holland still did not know about it, even though this was his field of expertise. A dramatic example of the fact that this building's collapse has not been prominent in the public consciousness was provided in a New York City courtroom in September 2009. Judge Edward Lehner was hearing arguments about a petition sponsored by New York City CAN to allow residents to vote on whether New York City should have its own investigation of the World Trade Center attacks. After Judge Lehner had observed that the 9/11 Commission had already investigated 9/11 and had issued a report, Dennis McMahon, a lawyer for New York City CAN, said that this report had left many unanswered questions. One of the biggest questions, he added, is why did Building 7 come down? At which point Judge Lehner said, "Building what?" McMahon replied, "World Trade Center 7. There were three buildings that came down." When the judge, continuing to illustrate his ignorance about this building, asked if it was the one owned by the Port Authority, McMahon replied, "No, it was owned by Larry Silverstein." Judge Lehner, it should be emphasized, is not simply an ordinary American citizen. Besides being a judge who was presiding in New York City, he was assigned to a case involving the 9/11 attacks in this city. So his ignorance about this building was surprising, and yet it was typical. With his query, "Building what?" he expressed the ignorance manifested in 2006 by controlled demolition expert Daniel Winkel and almost half of the American people. How can we account for this widespread ignorance? In a New York Times story in November 2001, James Glantz wrote that the collapse of World Trade Center 7 was a mystery that under normal circumstances would probably have captured the attention of the city and the world. Clearly, these were not normal circumstances. Part of the abnormality was the fact that Building 7, while huge, was overshadowed by the Twin Towers, which were over twice as tall. But this fact by itself would not account for the enormous ignorance, because, as people indicated at the time, as Glantz pointed out, there were reasons why the collapse of 7 should have been an even bigger story than the collapse of the towers. Why was it not? The answer seems to be that it was a deliberately suppressed story. This conclusion is supported by the following facts. First, after 9/11 itself, our television networks played videos of the Twin Towers being hit by the planes and then collapsing over and over and over. But the collapse of Building 7 was seldom, if ever, shown again on mainstream television. Second, when the 9/11 Commission report was issued in 2004, it did not even mention the collapse of this building. Third, after NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, took over from FEMA the task of explaining the destruction of World Trade Center, it repeatedly delayed its report on Building 7 over and over. In 2003, NIST said that this report would be issued along with its report on the Twin Towers, the draft of which was to appear in September 2004. However, even though NIST's report on the Twin Towers did not actually appear until 2005, the promised report on Building 7 was not included. NIST said it would appear in 2006. But when August of 2006 came, NIST said, "It is anticipated that a draft report on World Trade Center 7 will be released by early 2007. But it was not released in 2007, whether early or late. NIST instead projected that it would release draft reports on July 8, 2008, followed by final reports in August of that year. Instead, the draft report did not appear until August, and the final report not until November of 2008, when the Bush-Cheney administration was about to leave office. Moreover, in 2008, when NIST was accused of having deliberately delayed this report, it lied, saying that it had worked on this report only since 2005 and hence for only 3 years, the same amount of time it had worked on the report of the Twin Towers. However, NIST had filed progress reports on World Trade Center 7 in December 2002 and May 2003. In June 2004, it published an interim report, and in April 2005, it released another preliminary report. Then, after ceasing work on this building, evidently, while finishing up the report on the Twin Towers in 2005, NIST then said the investigation of World Trade Center 7 resumed. In truth, therefore, NIST had worked on its report on Building 7 for almost 6 years, not merely three. So there was good reason to suspect that it had been deliberately delayed. In any case, when the draft for public comment did finally appear in August 2008, it was announced at a press conference with much bravado. Shyam Sunder, NIST lead investigator for the World Trade Center, said, "Our take-home message today is that the reason for the collapse of World Trade Center 7 is no longer a mystery. World Trade Center 7 collapsed because of fires fueled by office furnishings. It did not collapse from explosives." The mainstream media, for the most part, simply repeated Sunder's claims. For example, an Associated Press story entitled, "Report, Fire, Not Bombs, Leveled World Trade Center 7 Building," began by saying, "Federal investigators said Thursday they have solved a mystery of September 11th, the collapse of World Trade Center 7 Building 7, a source of long-running conspiracy theories." Then, after reinforcing this message by quoting Sunder's assurance that the reason for the collapse of World Trade Center 7 is no longer a mystery, this story concluded by quoting Sunder's claim that the science behind NIST's finding is incredibly conclusive, so that the public should really recognize that science is really behind what we have said. However, reporters could have easily discovered that this was not so. They could have seen, in fact, that NIST World Trade Center 7 report committed scientific fraud in the technical sense, as defined by the National Science Foundation. One type of fraud is falsification, which includes omitting data. NIST, while claiming it found no evidence of a controlled demolition event, simply omitted an enormous amount of evidence that explosions had brought World Trade Center 7 down. Besides failing to mention the testimonial evidence discussed earlier, NIST's report on this building omitted various types of physical evidence. Take, for example, the piece of Swiss cheese steel reported by the three professors. This was included as an appendix to the 2002 FEMA report. And after describing this piece of steel, the professors said, "A detailed study into the mechanism of this phenomenon is needed." When NIST took over from FEMA the responsibility of explaining the destruction of the World Trade Center, NIST director promised that its reports would address all major recommendations contained in the FEMA report. However, when NIST report on Building 7 appeared in 2008, it did not even mention this mysterious piece of Swiss cheese steel. Indeed, NIST even claimed that no steel from Building 7 was identified. Another example, Deutsche Bank, which had a building close to the World Trade Center that had been contaminated with dust, hired the R.J. Lee Group, a scientific research organization, to prove to its insurance company that the dust contaminating its building was not ordinary building dust, as the insurance company was claiming, but had resulted from the destruction of the World Trade Center. The reports issued by the R.J. Lee Company proved that the dust was indeed World Trade Center dust because it had its unique chemical signature. Part of this signature was spherical iron particles, and this meant, the R.J. Lee Group said, that iron had melted during the World Trade Center event, producing spherical metallic particles. The R.J. Lee Group also found that temperatures had been reached at which lead would have undergone vaporization, meaning over 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Hence, the R.J. Lee reports, which were issued in 2003 and 2004, provided additional evidence that temperatures had been reached that significantly exceeded those that could have been produced by fire. These reports, which were made known in an article published in January 2008 by a group of scientists led by physicist Stephen Jones, were simply ignored by NIST. Another study was carried out by scientists at the U.S. Geological Survey, which is a government agency. Besides also finding iron particles, these scientists found that something had melted molybdenum, which has an extremely high melting point, almost 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Although these scientists failed to mention this discovery in the published version of their report, the Stephen Jones Group, having obtained their data through a FOIA report, pointed out that these U.S. Geological Survey scientists had devoted considerable study to this particle of molybdenum. So they didn't just overlook it. They had suppressed this information. NIST, however, failed to mention this discovery, even though it was by another federal agency. Still another example, a report by Stephen Jones and several other scientists, including University of Copenhagen chemist Niels Herit, showed that the World Trade Center dust contained an unreacted nanothermite. Unlike ordinary thermite, which is an incendiary, nanothermite is a high explosive. This report by Herit, Jones, and their colleagues did not appear until 2009, so NIST in 2008 could not have mentioned it. However, given the standard guidelines for investigating fires, they definitely should have checked the dust for evidence of thermite and its various forms, including thermite and nanothermite. When asked whether it did, NIST said no. When reporter Jennifer Abel of the Hartford Advocate asked NIST spokesman Michael Newman why not, he replied, because there was no evidence of that. When she asked the obvious follow-up question, "How can you know there's no evidence if you don't look for it first?" he replied, "If you're looking for something that isn't there, you're wasting your time and the taxpayers' money." Besides omitting evidence, when I made that statement in Cambridge the other night, Lynn Margulis was in the audience, and she piped up, "This is the first time they've ever shown any concern about wasting the taxpayers' money." Besides omitting evidence, partly by simply refusing to look for it, NIST also committed the type of scientific fraud called fabrication, which means simply making up results. For example, in offering its explanation as to how fire caused Building 7 to collapse, NIST said that the culprit was thermal expansion, which means simply that the fire heated up the steel and it expanded. Expanding steel beams on the 13th floor, NIST claims, caused a steel girder connecting columns 44 and 79 to break loose. Having lost its support, column 79 failed, starting a chain reaction that led all 81 other columns to fail. Now, ignoring the question of whether that's even remotely possible, let's just focus on the issue, why did that girder fail? NIST's answer was, in World Trade Center 7, no studs were installed on the girders. These are shear studs, big things. In another passage, NIST said, floor beams had shear studs, but the girders that supported the floor beams did not have shear studs. However, NIST's interim report on World Trade Center 7, which was issued back in 2004, before it had developed this girder failure theory, had said that shear studs were used to anchor most of the beams and girders, including the particular girder in question. Another example of fabrication. Although in its 2004 interim report, NIST had said that by 4:45 p.m. that day, the fire on floor 12 was burned out, it claimed in its 2008 report that at 15 minutes later, 5 o'clock, just 21 minutes before the building collapsed, this fire was still going strong. Both of these examples of fabrication, incidentally, were discovered by Chris Sarnes, who is here today. Chris, where are you? Stand up. You deserve applause for that.
You just heard the first part of a speech given by Dr. David Ray Griffin at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California, on May 15, 2010. The second and final part of that speech will be aired in a few weeks. You can also hear the entire speech by going to the website understandingdeeppolitics.org. And now I want to tell you about a new website that was launched in August. It's called 9/11 Truth News, and the website is 911truthnews.com. And here's what the editors have to say about 9/11 Truth News. 9/11 Truth News is intended to be an accessible and factually oriented first reference for those curious about 9/11 truth. Our movement must serve its audience, and this site was created for that purpose. The key to effectively serving this purpose is our strategy. That starts with the site being solely related to 9/11 truth and edited by four longtime movement activists. So I encourage you to check that new website out, 911truthnews.com. The group Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth has also launched an annual newspaper called the 9/11 Investigator. The first annual edition is available on their website, ae911truth.org. And here's what Richard Gage has to say about it. The 9/11 Investigator goes where no mainstream newspaper has dared by detailing the witness testimony and scientific forensic evidence behind the destruction of the three World Trade Center high-rises on 9/11. This handy publication presents the compelling case for explosive-controlled demolition in a graphically oriented, easy-to-read format while maintaining the scientific integrity that is honored by technical professionals around the globe. So you can get yourself a copy of the 9/11 Investigator by going to their website, ae911truth.org. 9/11 Wake Up Call airs on Thursdays at 2:30 on WWUH 91.3 FM and on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on WESU 88.1 FM. And you can also listen to some of the shows at ct911truth.org or on radioforall.net. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.